Hello everyone, my name is Crystal Hicks.
And my name is Lucy Malarkey.
And we're from WISH, which is womeninsocialhousing.org, and you're listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast.
This is a podcast where we delve deeper into stories from inspirational women who work in the social housing sector, to understand the barriers that they've overcome, to be inspired by their journeys, and to learn from their experiences. And we'll of course be asking the big question, if they had one wish, what would it be and why?
Hello everybody and welcome to the latest episode of the If I Had One Wish podcast. I am Crystal Hicks and I am joined today by...
Lucy Malarkey.
So we are delighted to have Alison Inman as our guest on our podcast today. Alison is a familiar and much loved face in the housing sector, having been a leading figure in the sector for many years. She is a past president of the Chartered Institute of Housing and former chair of the National Federation of ALMOS, as well as co-founder of Shout, the social housing campaign group. In April this year, she was appointed as the new independent chair of TPAS, the Housing Engagement Experts, and she currently sits on the board of two housing associations in the east of England. As listeners will know, Alison regularly writes for the trade press and has spoken at many housing events. She's known for her commitment to social fairness. She's known for her commitment to social housing, fairness and social justice, as well as her belief in the potential of people and communities to bring about positive and lasting change. Alison is a member of the Labour Housing Group, a socialist society affiliated to the Labour Party for members who care about housing and homelessness. And with her legendary status, we are delighted to welcome Alison. Thank you for joining us today, Alison.
Hello.
Hello.
Sorry, I hate listening to people say things about me. So, hello. I've cringed my way through the then, so we've got that out the road.
Well, it's all very true. So, Alison, as you're aware, our podcast is really just about having conversations with people, learning more about their experiences as female leaders and change makers. So we'd like to learn a little bit more about you today, especially some of maybe the challenges that you've overcome throughout your career and lessons that can be learned from those. So would you mind talking us through your career journey, please? What brought you into social housing? And more importantly, I suppose, what made you stay?
So that is a question that strikes fear into my heart for reasons I will explain to you. I hate being asked, what's your career journey? Because I haven't really had one. And, you know, I imagine that most people who come onto your podcast talk about imposter syndrome, PhD, postdoctoral status, imposter syndrome in our house. How did I end up here? So I did a law degree at university, and I learned that I didn't want to be a solicitor doing conveyancing, which would probably have been the sort of career option open to me. So I went to work for Coventry Citizens Advice Bureau, and I spent 18 months at the CAB, a year of it unpaid but working. You know, there were different times. You had to be available for work in order to get benefits in those days. It was, you know, the benefit system was a completely different kettle of fish to what it is now. And it, you know, so I was lucky enough to you know, I was in receipt of benefits, but volunteering every single day at the CAB. And then I got a job on what was called, gosh, the old, and it was like an offshoot of the YTS. It was the Manpower Services Commission, Manpower, goodness me, we've moved on. Manpower Services Commission, Community Programme, it was called. And so I spent 6 months then being paid to do outreach work in Coventry, which was fascinating. And there are a number of people of around my sort of age who had, you know, spent some time within a citizen's advice and for whom it was transformative. Everything I have done, you know, in the nearly 40 years since then, I can sort of do a dotted line back to my experiences. It's an incredible organisation. It's absolutely, you know, absolutely wonderful. And I look back at some of the people I met, you know, the clients we had, the work we did. And it was a funny time, you know, so I went there in 1984. The miners' strike was on, you know, you know, one of the things about getting older is you realise that things that were absolutely central to making you who you are the things that the next generations learn about in history books. And I find that a little bit difficult to get my head around. So it was a very political time. People's work was often an extension of their politics, I think, and vice versa. So that was life changing for me. And then I got a job in Basildon. So I grew up in halfway between Manchester and Liverpool. I went to uni in Coventry and then ended up in Essex. So I ended up in Basildon. So this new town in South Essex. I'd never been to Essex. Didn't really know where it was, what it was like. And but this new town that was just, it was a really interesting time. I loved it, absolutely loved it. And again, so I was doing welfare rights and advocacy and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It was, again, it was very political, I think, the work that we did. Political probably with a little p, sometimes with a big p that wouldn't be allowed nowadays, but it felt like it mattered. And I think, you know, doing work that you feel is important is something that still drives me now, and I know drives other generations of people. It's not just sitting in an office and, you know, doing boring stuff. It's that sort of impact, I suppose. So I did that. I then moved into what we now call, I don't know what we now call it. This is one of the things when you get to the end of a career and you look back. So we used to have a personnel department. At some point that became human resources. And then, you know, you have a week off work and you come back and it's people and culture and you think, bloody hell, how did that happen? And it takes you a little while to realise it's just the same. It's just got a new name. If we still had headed note paper, we'd have different paper. So I worked doing within the local authority, doing sort of training, organising, development and stuff like that. And I suppose I was on a bit of a trajectory. I spent a year on a settlement doing work around the poll tax, which when I look back to think what my job description would have been if I'd had one, it was probably get people to carry on voting Labour despite the fact that they're paying a very high poll tax. This is pre sort of local government rules around sort of political activity and influence amongst officers. They really were sort of different times. So I carried on doing that and I loved local government. And then probably one of the things that's had the biggest influence on me and my life is that I got ME. That wasn't on my playbook. That wasn't on the plan. I completely and utterly identified myself through my work. That was my biggest thing. And suddenly I couldn't work. And I was, you know, devastated and really, really poorly. And that's a long, long time ago. And I have not done a full-time job since then. And I find it really difficult to talk about because for many, actually until the pandemic, ME was something that, you know, people were a little bit iffy about, a little bit, it's not real, is it? And it wasn't until people began to see the links and the similarities, I think, between long COVID and ME CFS, going, maybe it's a real thing. Sorry, this is a really long answer, isn't it?
It's absolutely fine.
But I don't tend to talk about it because I feel a sense of shame that I do not have, you know, my LinkedIn does not have very much in about me because I feel like, you know, I haven't had that sort of career journey that other people have done. But on the positive side of it, I have done, you know, since then I've been able to do a variety of things. You know, like I was a magistrate for nearly 20 years. You know, I'd spent a lot of time, you know, volunteering within women's refuge movement. I, you know, sat on the, you know, done lots and lots of school governor stuff, charity stuff, you know, picking up bits of money here, there and everywhere, and not very, you know. And then I joined the board of my local Almo, so Colchester Borough Homes, which was a relatively early Almo. And I just sort of like, it was a bit like, oh wow, right, okay. This sort of knits together absolutely everything that I've done in the, you know, preceding 15 years or whatever. And this sort of makes sense to me. I, you know, if a bit local, you know, back in local, the world of local government, even though, you know, at arm's length, always loved housing. And I suppose what I'd learnt in the intervening years was I love how organisations work and how they are accountable. And I think that's really, really important. You know, how are they accountable to whether it's, you know, tenants, clients, users, what, you know, whatever sector you're in, parents, children, communities, how are they accountable to regulators, you know, how do you keep them honest and true to their purpose? And then I started doing all that, you know, more and more sort of housing stuff, which has been great. But for somebody, I once worked with somebody, and maybe we could talk about not everything works out all the time, because I think that's really important when you're, you know, as we go from different organisations. I've been really lucky. I've worked with incredible, incredible people. I've also landed one time in particular in an organisation that just was not for me. It was an absolute disaster. It was awful, and it took me, well, it's taken me the best part of 10 years to get over that, you know, the impact of the toxicity of that experience. But we tend not to talk about that kind of thing. You know, and in housing, there are a lot of people who are bruised and damaged by experiences that they have had. You know, we have amazing leadership in the sector, but we also have some pretty toxic leadership. And you know, it both breaks my heart and makes me absolutely fucking cross that we, you know, sometimes people with who do bad stuff are allowed to thrive in the sector.
I think that, you know, that something happened to me. I went to work for an organisation for a short period of time because, like you, I learned, well, I found out very soon that the culture, the values were not aligned to my own. And you know, I think there is something really in that about the really important lessons that we can learn from those, but equally, you know, the damage that can do. But, you know, I suppose reflecting positively on the fact that we can learn from those, that the grass isn't always greener, because I made that mistake of jumping for money rather than that, you know, focusing on what you've said, on what matters. Yeah. That's got to be a key driver, hasn't it, for us all in terms of values alignment. You know, if it's aligned to our values, then less likely generally to find that toxicity and to be able to give our best self.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think if I look back and I'm really honest with myself, there were signs, like really early, probably before I went there, that this wasn't going to work, but I really wanted it. You know, I wanted to do it, and I thought, if I can pivot enough, I can, you know, I can make
others
it
work. Others will change.
You make all sorts of compromises, don't you? You sort of talk yourself into it.
And we beat ourselves up for that, and I think women are more likely, you know, it's obviously not only women, but women are more likely to sort of internalise, I think, those sort of things and think, well, it's me, you know. And just sometimes we are the wrong shape to fit into an organisation, and that's all right, actually. You know, that's fine.
So is that the advice you would give to the younger version of you? Listen to, you know, your gut in advance.
Absolutely trust your gut. Absolutely trust your gut. I think that's so important. And that is across, you know, I was thinking, what would my advice to the younger me be? If a relationship isn't making you happier, then not being in a relationship would make you then get out, I think. It's really important. And similarly, if that's the same with work. And I read something recently that like was fascinating around, you know, people are a lot younger than me and are not a lot younger even than, you know, you two. That once people have done a job for about 18 months, they think it's time for the next promotion and the next promotion and the next promotion. And I noticed that when I was a chair of governors at a school for a long time, and for about 10 years. And within that time, we saw a real change that you get newly qualified teachers coming in. And after 2 years, they'd be wanting to be, you know, leadership roles or UPS roles or something. And it's like, well, it was a real shock because that didn't used to be the sort of way it was. And I just wonder, I mean, ambition is great. And I think often if you use the word ambition and in the same sentence as woman, then that's seen as something negative. And I'm not having that. But there's something about those hard yards, I think, something about, you know, investing in just being in a role at some point. It sometimes feels like people think they've got to be chasing something and chasing something and chasing something. And if you think about, you know, the housing association sector, there's 200 large developing housing associations. I think anyone's going to be a chief exec. You know, there's not that many, what, four times as many exec director roles? There's, you know, there's tens and tens of thousands of people working in housing, and to be the best housing officer is an incredible thing to be. You know, there's nothing, you don't have to be an exec director. You don't always have to be chasing the next thing. We put loads and loads of pressure on ourselves. So I'd be thinking, like, so I'm chairing TPAS, and I love chairing TPAS. I wouldn't chair another housing association because I really like being a board member. I like what you're able to do as a board member that you're not able to do as a chair. And I don't think I should feel like that's unambitious of me, because my ambition is to be really good at that. Does that make sense?
Totally. Giving all you've got to what the role that you're in is what I'm hearing there.
Yeah. I think, you know, that thing as well around that continuous progression upwards, up the chain, and this myth that that will lead to more and more satisfaction. And actually, you know, when I do speak to people who are sort of caught towards the end of their careers, what I often hear is, you know, it was the earlier roles that brought most satisfaction and brought most, I suppose, that the opportunities to learn and to really go where your heart sings. Whereas sort of the more senior you get, sometimes the further away you get from tenants, the further away you get maybe from the reason you came into the sector. So I think there's sometimes a bit of a myth, isn't there, that, oh, you'll be happier and happier the more senior you go.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure that's true. And so I did want to ask you around sort of like opportunities that you've taken up. And it was really, thank you for being sort of open with us around sort of your ME and what that's meant for you. You've taken up a lot of opportunities though, in spite of that. You've done some incredible things. But is there anything that maybe you would have liked to have done, or any doors that were presented to you that you didn't go through, that you look back now and you think, oh, that would have been really interesting to have given that a go?
I think 10 years ago I'd have said yes. Whereas now I think things I regret not doing were things that were never for me in the first place.
That's interesting, yeah.
I met a wonderful woman, gosh, 15 years ago. I don't know if you remember Sarah Webb, who was, she's the, she was chief executive of the Chartered Institute of Housing.
Yes.
And sadly, and very tragically, Sarah died in 2011. And she was super, and she did something that I tried to do for other women, because she would open doors for people, and she'd basically like kick you up the bum and send you into the room, and then she's like, you're on your own. So it wasn't, you know, a sort of dumbing down thing. It wasn't trying to get anyone to anywhere that they weren't meant to be or weren't able to be or whatever, but she just opened the door. And I just think there is, we can be really generous if we choose. So, you know, always think about who's coming after you. I think that's really, really important. And I feel that, you know, I feel that now. I'm 61. You know, I haven't got 20 years doing this stuff. And I'm really invested on having fantastic younger women coming up behind who are just going to, I think my generation strived really hard in lots and lots of spaces, whether that's, you know, domestic, you know, women in the domestic abuse sector or within housing or whatever. And we genuinely have tried, and we genuinely haven't sorted it. you know, 150,000 children have experienced temporary accommodation, you know, this year on any night. That's not, you know, that's not, we've sorted it.
No.
You know, the rates of domestic abuse are as high as they ever have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've not sorted that. So I need to know that there are people coming behind who can do that. And I don't understand people who sort of, you know, pull the ladder up behind them.
Yeah. And we've heard, you know, in previous conversations that we've had, Alison, about you opening doors, actually, and CIH Futures is probably, you know, a really good example of that. And, you know, we've talked with some previous podcast guests about CIH Futures and you opening those doors for people. So tell us about CIH Futures, you know, how that came about and you know, the opening doors that does.
Well, there are some, I mean, there's a wonderful woman called Judy, and this is a sign of my age because I can't remember her last name. So a lot of this, you know, was on her watch. I was on the CIH board for about 6 years, I think. That was fascinating, actually. I'm going to digress for a moment. Because, if you know, I went on to that when I was the chair of the National Federation of LMOs, and it was like they'd picked, you know, it was the great and the good. It was if a computer had appointed a board, that is exactly the right, that's the board that would have come out the other end of the, you know, sausage machine. On paper, it should have been perfect, and in reality, it didn't work. And I think that's fascinating because we always need to be thinking about people and how they're going to work together, as opposed to getting the right people with the right titles in a room who just, you know, either don't do anything or it just doesn't work or whatever. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot there. But there were these, you know, we've obviously got a regional structure in CIH and all these incredible young people, and it was just a joy to be part of enabling that to take place. But more than that, I always feel that it's not enough. Just, you know, you have to be in. One of the things you can do for other people is be interested in them, and a lot of people aren't. And I think that's a real shame. I've never had a conversation with someone who works in housing and not learned something, or not found, you know, a point of human sort of contact. So, and I've been really lucky to meet all these young people, and then we got them all in the same room, and oh my God, you know, just phenomenal people, whether it's, you know, Evie Coatland up in Berwickshire, or, you know, Adam Clark, or, you know, Cheryl Tracy over in Wales, or Ellie Holt, who's now, you know, president of CIH, and Neil Goodrich, you know, all these incredible people who are very different. You know, Steve Ellard, who I think is now gone on to Ongo. They just work together in a different way, and I think CIH was in some respects quite brave, because you had this bunch of people who challenged the social, that, you know, the status quo, worked completely differently. They weren't interested in, you know, agendas and minutes or whatever. It's like they'll put something on Slack and, you know, all these other words that I feel slightly a frisson of something when I say, because it doesn't come naturally to me. And just be, you know, just take time to talk to people, because, you know, everybody's got a story, and, you know, if you learn a bit about people, you can then put people in touch with it, you know, just that sort of joining people up, and, you know, they've got all this energy and all this commitment and compassion and stuff, so it's a joy to work with them.
Sorry, so I was just going to say that, Alison, is, you know, what we heard, you know, is that inspired by you and the others around the room with you to recognise that the door had been opened for them, and to take that challenge, to be inspired to do something about it. And I think that's so important and really, really powerful. And I'm sure you're absolutely right that actually caring about somebody, listening to understand what it is, what they're about, what, you know, and then supporting them by opening the door so that they can do that, make that positive difference that they want to do.
I remember the organisation where I didn't fit, you also have to accept that, you know, some good stuff can come out as well. And I met Adam, who was previously at North Star. He was given the job of driving me around one day to, you know, look at stuff, and then taking me out for lunch. That was his sort of job description. And I remember we ended up stood in Great Yarmouth outside of Greg's eating sausage rolls, because we were just talking about ASB and, you know, family support and all that. You know, it was just a conversation that was about, you know, the work, but in such a humane approach. So this you can be professional and humane and kind and compassionate and still collect the rent and make sure that the gas servicing is done and, you know, all the other stuff. And we sometimes put people in boxes that, oh, well, they're the kind ones, they're the hard as nails ones, they're the this, they're the that. And actually we're all of those bits.
So do you mind if we sort of change tact a little bit and start to look forward to the future? Is that okay? So thinking about the future, Alison, we've got a new government. And you are a member of the Labour-affiliated group, the Labour Housing Group. So we're just really interested to hear a little bit more about the group, I suppose, and the influence that group might have on impacting future policy.
So Labour Housing Group is one of the socialist societies. I think there's about 20 of them. You know, like Socialist Health Organisation, and, you know, CERA, the environmental campaign, and such like. So it is a group of people who are basically interested in and concerned with the agenda, or political agenda around housing, want to make a difference. It is fascinating, because we are currently talking about our influencing strategy, and actually how you influence in government is very different to how you influence in opposition. So obviously, you know, feeding stuff into the opposition is relatively straightforward, because, you know, everyone's grateful for any bit of, you know, information and whatever that you can give them. They're very, you know, not particularly well staffed. once you move into government, you've got this whole machinery of government. You've got the entire civil service, as well as, you know, lots of paid political advisors and things. So actually, we're having to sort of adjust the way the rest, you know, everybody has to adjust when there's a new government. So we are obviously delighted by the commitment to build 1.5 million homes in the course of this parliament. It's a couple of things, you know, on a personal perspective, I think I'd have argued for possibly 3 million over 10 years, because I think we're going to have real difficulty hitting that target. And once you set a target and you don't hit it, then you're in really difficult political territory. But then again, I'm not the Prime Minister, am I? And the other thing I think is missing is a target for social housing. I think it would have been really, really helpful to know what the government's aspiration is for the proportion of that 1.5 million to be genuinely affordable. So I think the work on the green belts, you know, going to be really interesting, see what that unlocks. I think one of the most interesting things to have an eye on is what devolution, you know, what that whole devolution agenda means for housing and money in particular. You know, I think what we've suffered from over many, many years is a national solution to a southeast problem. And that, you know, I imagine I'm preaching to the converted here, but, you know, what works in the city of Westminster doesn't necessarily work in Morpeth. So that sort of nuance, I think. So I think it's, you know, what else is coming down the track? We're going to hope to influence on, you know, Decent Homes too. I think will be absolutely key to the work that the sector does over the next 10 years. It's good to see Right to Buy, you know, I'd argue to abolish it, but really if you remove the discount, it's, you know, the same sort of outcome, I suppose. So that, you know, we've got a Secretary of State who grew up in council housing, who knows, you know, speaks very convincingly about, you know, the role of safe and secure housing in enabling her life to be how it is. I think what we are going to be looking at, though, is how we influence the new MPs, because I think that's going to be key. And I think, you know, already had caught, you know, contact from new MPs going, oh my goodness, how do I sort this? And at the moment, the answer is we can't. So an MP, you know, contacted me not that long ago. It was on a Saturday evening, and she, you know, said there's a woman sleeping rough in the local park because she's got a dog. She can't, you know, homelessness won't pick her up. What do I do? And I was like, well, it's really difficult. You know, there aren't solutions. And I think influencing that group of people so they understand what needs to be done so that they can help their constituents is probably a key way of influencing government. That makes sense.
It does, yeah. Yeah, it really does make sense. And I think it's that challenge of, you know, there's a legacy issue here.
Yeah.
Around, call it what you like, lack of investment, underinvestment in social housing. And that ship takes a while to turn. And in the meantime, as you say, we've got people experiencing homelessness and there's just no immediate solutions. So how do you get that balance between throwing money at, you know, trying to bring some humanity to this situation, that there are people experiencing some really horrendous temporary accommodation and lack of access?
So there are some real, real bad bastards making a lot of money out of homeless people. You know, we are seeing benefit farms, in effect, where, you know, we've permitted development rights and the Office to Residential Conversions, which I'm sure the people who thought of that thought they would all end up as nice flats for their, you know, children to buy, not that they would be dumping grounds for people with incredibly complex needs, with the highest of rents being charged, you know, highest possible rents for the lowest provision of services. You know, it's not that long, 2011, I think, that the duty to rehouse people who were homeless could only be discharged into the social sector. You know, well, you know, that is, you know, that just removing that has meant, you know, we've got this round, this sort of, what do you call it, revolving door of people, you know, who are homeless, being discharged into the PRS, 6 months, 12 months later, they're homeless again, you know, and Kelsa Breeze, you know, we're just going round and round and round. You know, it's going to be the leading cause of local authority bankruptcy. And in a similar way, I was looking at some of the statistics for children's homes, you know, when you, in effect, privatise, you know, let the market deal with everything, then it, you know, it's often doesn't drive the best outcomes. So it can cost, you know, £100,000, I think I read, a week to put the children with the most complex needs into residential care. There must be a way of doing it that provides more compassionate care and better value for money, but we seem to have lost sight of that.
You've identified some massive challenges there, you know, some of which I hadn't particularly thought about, particularly around the MPs, and you know that if, you know, if you don't understand the issues, then how can you help to be part of the solution and shape the agenda? And I think, you know, perhaps, you know, because we've all got that social housing background or fairly immersed in it, we forget that others don't see or don't know that there is that woman sleeping in the park, because she is there. And she's in every town, you know, all over the place, isn't she? So I think there's some massive challenges that you've identified there. And, you know, and I suppose what's been great to hear from you today is about that opening doors for others, because we might not all, us sitting in this virtual room here now, have all the answers to that. But if we can open the doors to other people who can have other thoughts, different ways of approaching some of these problems, that some are relatively newer, some have been around for a long time, then that's got to be part of the answer. But I want to, sorry, Alison, were you going to say something there?
No, I was just thinking about Wish and the sort of role of, you know, if Wish in making links with local MPs and just, you know, talking a little bit about, you know, some of those issues that they're facing in their constituency. Service, you know, surgeries, and we, because people are always surprised when the system is as shit as it is.
So most
MPs would probably, you know, new MPs would not know that a woman, you can leave refuge with your belongings in black bin bags, you get a council flat, and there's no bed, there's no oven, there's no fridge, and there's bare floorboards.
No. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, people on housing association boards are shocked when they learn that. You know, MPs will be absolutely astounded that we just sort of go, yeah, that's our bit done. You know, we don't even put, you know, often we don't put blinds up, or not only do we not put blinds up, we take curtain rails down, we rip carpets out, pushing people into poverty, into even greater poverty. I'm not sure what it does for net zero to be binning off of, you know, a load of carpets down the tip. And yet, you know, we sort of see ourselves as wholly virtuous. And I think, you know, sometimes it just needs that enough people to point out, that's not, no, in 21st century, it's not good enough.
So, Alison, that brings us very neatly, and I don't know if you'll be able to answer this with a one answer, but the question that we ask all of our podcast guests, the final question, is about if you had one wish. So, Alison, I'm going to ask you, if you had one wish for the sector, What would it be and why?
The easy answer would be a shed load of money. But in the meantime, while we are waiting for that.
For that miracle.
Yeah. It would be, I suppose, to, for organisations, it's a bit of, look back to the Better Social Housing Review, there was some real common sense in there. Do the stuff that's really important. It sometimes feels like organisations, maybe some senior leaders, they get a bit bored with repairing toilets, actually. Like running a unicorn farm is far more interesting than actually thinking hard about how can we cover up floorboards. So I would, my wish is that we stick to our core purpose and look after our properties as well as we possibly can, provide brilliant services as, you know, as good as we possibly can, concentrate on that, and that'll be a really good bedrock. And it's a really boring answer, but my wish is we sort of stick to the knitting for a little while so that when the pot of money does arrive, we're in the best possible space to spend it well, because we're only going to get it once.
Fantastic. Alison, it has been an absolute delight to have you on our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Alison.
Thank you for the opportunity. I thought I was not going to have anything to say, but I think that's probably wrong.
Alison, when would you ever not have anything to say?
Well, thank you. It's been really interesting and great to chat to you both. So thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the If I Had One Wish podcast. Next time, we'll be talking to another inspirational female from the housing sector who will be sharing her career story and what she's learned along the way. And of course, we'll be asking again the big question. If she had one wish, what would it be and why? See you next time.